I would just suggest that people take this requirement seriously, talk to their lawyer about it, talk to their accountant. Many accountants are set up to help people comply with this statute.
That was Mike Lindsay. Mike and I have a deep dive into the Corporate Transparency Act, but after the podcast was recorded, but before it was released, District Court from Northern Alabama invalidated the CTA as unconstitutional. So we have an addendum where we talk about that court case. This is a fascinating episode. I know you'll enjoy it. First, a word from Nick Gallo.
Handling multiple compliance cases can often feel like navigating a complex labyrinth. Ethico introduces simplicity and intelligence into this chaos with our custom workflow automation. By automatically routing cases based on your unique criteria, we turn the maze into a clear path forward. Envision a compliance process that's not just effective, but also intuitive and adaptable to your needs. It's time to redefine efficiency in your workplace. Embark on this journey of transformation at ethico.com/CPN. Book a demo, read our white paper by Tom Fox titled The ROI of Compliance, and try our free ROI calculator to discover a world of seamless compliance management.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back with another episode, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have back with me Mike Lindsay. Mike, first of all, welcome back to the pod. It's been a while.
Thank you. It's a delight to see you, and I'm back in my office and not working from home with the pandemic.
Mike, could you remind our audience what firm you're with and the nature of your practice?
Yes, I'm a corporate and transactional lawyer with the law firm Steinbrecher and Spann. And many of us are offshoots of the very large firm Paul Hastings LLP, where many of us started. So I was with that firm for a long time, 1,200 lawyers and so forth. Now I'm at a firm with 12. It's a much more manageable enterprise.
Where are you guys located, Mike?
We're located in downtown Los Angeles, California. The great place for people to come for the summertime and other times as well.
So, Mike, I was thrilled when you asked about visiting on the Corporate Transparency Act, or I'm going to call it the CTA. You have learned the act well enough to be able to talk about the nuts and bolts, but I really wanted to explore with you some of the implications, some of your thoughts. You've actually written about it, and one of the few people who's commenting on it, I think you correctly noted, is a huge sea change that, frankly, I don't think many people understand is about to hit them. And it's not just a sea change of nuts and bolts filing. What's going to happen 3 years, 5 years, maybe even 10 years down the road? Could we start with you describing what the Corporate Transparency Act is?
Sure. The Corporate Transparency Act is a piece of federal legislation adopted in January of 2021, and it spent the past few years in administrative rigor developing regulations to implement the act. The act became fully effective on January 1st of this year. And the goal of the act is to help curb the misuse of legally formed entities in the United States, corporations, limited liability companies, and so forth, to curb their use for illegal activities like money laundering, tax evasion, and fraud. The underlying thought behind this statute was that by increasing the transparency of information about this kind of entity and their ownership, that it would stop criminals, or at least help stop criminals, from hiding their illegal gains derived from this country.
So one of the things I've observed in my corporate and compliance career is if you put a law in to prevent criminals from doing something, they generally find another way to do it. And maybe we can get to that later. But do you see the CTA as a game changer, or really just an evolution in what the Treasury Department wants to see around corporate filing information?
Yes, it is a game changer for privately held companies, because many publicly held companies have to do lots and lots of filings with the federal government. But historically, private companies don't have to report much. They have to report typically their corporate officers and directors and their agent for service or process, but they don't have to report what's at the hub of the statute, namely who their beneficial owners are. And that's very unusual for the United States. For private companies, small mom-and-pop held businesses and so forth, to have to report their beneficial owners.
So one of the things that I've thought a lot about is the database. And I've thought about it in terms of, if you have a database, may get hacked. If you have a database, people have access people who legitimately have access to it, but they may leak that information. Where do you shake out around the database? And is that something that we as the, if not consuming public, the corporate filers and corporations of America need to worry about?
I think we do need to worry about it because the quality of the data that's being reported on the so-called beneficial ownership information form is exactly what hackers would like to have and what is being traded daily on the dark web. All kinds of background information on the beneficial owners, especially particular identifying numbers such as their social security number, their driver's license, their home address, that sort of thing. Hackers would love to access this data. And thank goodness our federal government has been doing such a stellar job in protecting the security of its databases. That, of course, is a joke.
Who's a beneficial owner under the CTA, Mike?
Beneficial owners are people that fall into several categories. First is the people who have substantial control over the entity. They're people like the senior officers of the company, the CFO, the chief operating officer, the chief financial officer, and so forth. That's one category. And the other one is anyone who is authorized to make important decisions on behalf of the company. And there's also anybody who happens to have at least a 25% ownership in the reporting company. These reporting companies, by the way, are any kind of entity that is required to make a filing with a Secretary of State or equivalent in any particular U.S. state, such as articles of incorporation or articles of formation and similar types of filings.
Who or I guess who will have access to this? I assume Department of Treasury, perhaps FinCEN, but what about banks or other private institutions, Mike?
No, the private institutions don't have access to the information. What the people who do have access are certainly FinCEN, which is part of the U.S. Treasury Department, all of their employees, also a whole bunch of federal, state, local, tribal, and foreign law enforcement authorities. You can think that's a fairly large population of people who have access to the database. Anybody pretty much involved in law enforcement, national security, or intelligence activity will have access to it legally.
So the information that's going to be stored there, let me go back. I laughingly said that if criminals are told they can't do one thing, they tend to find another. You talked about legally formed corporations in America. Do you think that this law will deter criminals or even others from forming shell corporations, or they'll just move on to another way to do it?
I think you have to be realistic here. People who are true criminals face potential penalties for really much more dastardly acts than failing to comply with a beneficial ownership information form. And as I've said in an article that I published, you really can't think of any self-respecting member of the Sinaloa cartel wanting to have his name in a public database accessible by law enforcement authorities all around the world. I have a bad feeling that the true criminals, the real bad guys, are really not going to be complying with the statute.
Do you think we could see straw men come up in corporate filings as well?
You really are cynical, aren't you, Tom? But certainly, I think you can see that. And, of course, the people who are named as straw men have issues if they fail to comply or if they turn in the actual beneficial owners. For example, a loss of life. And so you're going to potentially see people making these filings and just omitting to say some of the people in the Sinaloa cartel being members.
What about the burden on businesses to comply? You talked about some of the basic requirements. How do you see that part of this shaking out?
There is an administrative burden because the officers of the company are going to have to go out and contact the owners of the company and ask for this kind of detailed information from them. So I think there will, at least initially, be an education process to get these beneficial owners to understand that this is a federal law. They need to comply with it. And they need to turn over this information. There's an alternative for the individual to go get a so-called FinCEN identifier, which any individual can do. They have to fill out a lot of additional paperwork and file it with FinCEN themselves directly. But if they provide a FinCEN identifier to the reporting company, that should be sufficient. Now, you have to think, too, about burden being spread around a lot of companies. The estimate is that this year alone, there will be 33 million filings in the United States and potentially going up as more and more companies are developed.
Mike, you live in a large metropolitan area. I live in a small rural area. I would say the knowledge of this law in my little hometown among both lawyers and business owners is pretty close to minuscule. Does that hold true in a large metropolitan area? Are you and others able to get this word out, or is it just a mixed bag?
I think it is a mixed bag, Don. That's a really good description of it, that law firms like mine have been communicating with their clients and saying, for you that have an existing company, you have a filing deadline by the end of this year. And when we form new companies, corporations, LLCs, and similar entities, we tell them at the outset, you have to file this form within 90 days after formation of the company. We're telling our clients, there are lots and lots of businesses out there that don't have regular legal access. And so I fear that some people could wind up having some penalties for failing to file. Now, the reality is that there are 33 million filings that are going to be made this year alone. The FinCEN staff is already burdened, and I don't see that they're being expanded any. So the people who are legally entitled to read these things are few and far between, as opposed to the number of hackers who will relish the opportunity to get access to the database.
Mike, the few times I've talked about this in my geographic area, the second question is, aren't there some exemptions? I'm a small business owner. I'm a family business. I'm a something. Are there exemptions to the CTA?
Yes, there are exemptions, but it doesn't apply to small businesses. They're basically large entities that are already heavily regulated by the federal government. Things like public companies, banks, savings and loans, that sort of thing, that already have fairly significant reporting obligations to the federal government, they're all exempt. But the mom and pop that have formed a limited liability company for asset protection and other reasons to run their neighborhood grocery store, they're not entitled to an exemption. And they're the ones who are going to have to make this filing.
I believe the comment period has ended, if there ever was one, for the rules and regulations on this. The law became effective January 1. Is there things that either we in the bar or the business community, Chamber of Commerce, others can do to raise awareness with the regulators about some of the hot issues we've highlighted, or is that time passed?
I think that time has passed. There was a comment period, and that's why it took so long to get the form published. It didn't actually get published in final form until December, with an effective date of January 1. So December 2023 and an effective date just a few weeks later. We're stuck with the form now. There may be opportunities to influence the regulators going forward. However, let's again be practical. The people who have influence with the regulators are the big companies who are already regulated. So the mom-and-pop grocery store, in my example, probably won't have a whole lot of traction with the FinCEN people to ask for relief, to ask for exemptions for mom-and-pops, that sort of thing.
What about any of the data privacy concerns that we've talked about in this podcast, or is that really left up to the good graces of the federal government and their hardened silos of data protection?
I think, unfortunately, it's alternative B, which is it's left up to the federal government. The federal government is compelling this information, much as they compel information from the exempt companies through other types of regulation. They're compelling this information, and they will put it in their so-called hardened silo, which is only accessible by anybody with a law enforcement badge anywhere in the world. It's pretty straightforward that... it's compelled. And the data privacy rules, what happens if there's a breach? Under any state rules and laws, there's a requirement that you notify the person who has been the subject of a breach, a data privacy breach. But there's no such rule at the federal level. There's federal legislation that's been proposed for quite some time that would supersede the patchwork quilt of state laws that we currently have. But that federal legislation is going nowhere, given the intransigence of our current legal setup in Congress.
Where do you see reporting requirements down the road, Mike? Are we looking at really a first pass at the basis or basic information that federal government is going to start to ask private companies for, or do you think this is probably what they'll stay with for several years?
I have a pretty good imagination, but even I can't imagine where the federal government will go next in terms of regulation. This is really very significant regulation of small businesses, which already have pretty significant burdens in the operation of their businesses. I would hope that no additional disclosure requirements are imposed. But if after a few years, the federal government determines that there has been widespread noncompliance, there could be some ratcheting up of additional requirements. Again, I don't have that wild an imagination.
Mike, as I recall, one of the reasons for the passage of this law, which I believe was part of the AML law of 2020, was to increase visibility into shell corporations. Do you think it will even fulfill that basic requirement, request, or need?
Yes, I do, for law-abiding American citizens. And by the way, it's also applicable to foreign entities that transact business in the U.S. and have to make any kind of filing with a state authority. So it should provide some additional visibility. But for example, do you think you will ever see a shell corporation disclose ownership by anybody in the Iran Revolutionary Guard? I don't.
I would certainly agree with that assessment as well. This is Tom Fox again. That concluded my original recording with Mike Lindsay on the Corporate Transparency Act. However, before the episode was posted, Judge Lyle Burke and the Northern District Court of Alabama invalidated and held unconstitutional the Corporate Transparency Act. Mike Lindsay and I got back together to discuss Judge Burke's opinion. Hello, everyone. If you happen to be watching on YouTube, you'll notice Mike and I have different shirts on, and Mike doesn't have a tie on. And there's a reason for that, is after we recorded the podcast, but before I posted it, we had a court case which invalidated the CTA. So I asked Mike if maybe we could have an addendum or an addition to the podcast where we talk about the court decision, and he graciously agreed to do so. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike, we had a very interesting case out of, I believe, the Northern District of Alabama, in a case styled National Small Business Union versus Janet Yellen in her official capacity as the Secretary of the Treasury. And in this case, the group NSBU, a lobby group for small national businesses, wanted to invalidate the CTA for a variety of reasons, and the district court accepted some of those reasons. So with that sort of that introduction, I wanted to maybe pitch it to you and see what you thought about the decision, what it might mean for the CTA going forward, and what are some of the core reasons you think the CTA was passed in the first place, and do they upstand or withstand constitutional muster?
I have to issue a disclaimer to start with. I'm not a constitutional law authority. I am a simple-minded corporate transactional attorney. That said, I understand the background for the CTA and am surprised at the decision that the court issued on March 1st, because in a 53-page opinion, which I'll proceed to read, no, I'm kidding, the court dismissed many of the reasons for supporting the CTA. So I was frankly surprised and a little disappointed. The court did, however, make some constructive comments as to how Congress could have fixed it through adding a handful of words to the statute. And I'm thinking, so we're going to declare something constitutional over the lack of a handful of words. That's news to me. In any event, I'm not sure how deeply we want to get into those issues, but the court dismissed the Commerce Clause theory, namely that Congress has an ability to enact legislation governing interstate commerce. The court said, wait a minute, you didn't say anything about commerce in this statute. Now, if that was just inartful drafting, shame on you, but you didn't say anything about commerce, and therefore you can't rely on that hook. the Commerce Clause has been read quite broadly to apply to lots of different things that are part of our daily life. But the court said it's not enough to inflict this statute on businesses across the country solely by reason of the fact that they use the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, such as telecommunications, Zoom, telephones, that sort of thing. And that's not enough to give Congress authority to regulate 33 million small businesses, which was the estimate that FinCEN provided to the court. So I think that's the biggest part of the decision. There are other parts of the decision that you can read and quibble with, but my view is that it's largely a quibbling decision. If the court is focused on missing six words that would have cured the thing.
Mike, the Commerce Clause, I am going to take you back. I know you took constitutional law at some point many years ago.
Yeah, back when it was chiseled on slates.
Right after the dinosaurs died. Okay. But there was a large change in the constitutional interpretation around the 30s, particularly around Roosevelt's New Deal. And there was a series of cases which broadened the expanse of the Commerce Clause, giving the government the power to regulate after the court had a change of heart or change of judges or justices. And so really from the 30s forward, you're absolutely right. We've had an expansive Commerce Clause. And this to me seems to be a cutback of that expansion, and that you articulated several ways that every corporation engages in interstate commerce now, whether or not no one has a browser where their email is stored in their same state. Many of us do business across state lines. Even if you are a local business, you're going to have sourced things that are across state lines. And in the 30s, there was a concept called, I believe, the River of Commerce, where in the decision which upheld the original National Labor Relations Act, finding that Congress had authority to regulate under the Commerce Clause. But there were also some other areas that the court commented on, and one that they didn't really comment on that I thought merited our discussion. The first is Congress has the right to approve treaties on behalf of the United States government. The president can negotiate, but they have to be approved by Congress. But Congress also has the right to enact laws implementing their U.S. treaty obligations. And under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, for instance, that was the U.S. treaty obligation in 1998 under the OECD was cited in a 2005 district court opinion as one of the reasons to uphold a part of the FCPA. So we've had a little bit of that in that arena, but the court said even if the U.S. has a treaty obligation to either identify owners of shell corporations or something similar like they tried to do in the CTA, that wasn't good enough because that was a backdoor way to legislate. Any thoughts on that? Is that a dynamic tension that is really unresolved by our Constitution?
I don't know about whether it's unresolved as a constitutional matter, but I think that it's a stretch to say that really this is mandated by any kind of treaty into which the U.S. has entered with any foreign power. That said, the United States is pretty much out there alone among industrialized nations with respect to not requiring this kind of information from shell corporations. Most other sophisticated countries around the world, those that are Western nations in particular, do mandate this sort of information to prevent exactly the sort of thing that the CTA was enacted to try to prevent. That is, to prevent the use of shell corporations and similar entities for illegal purposes, for fraud, support of terrorism, for financial shenanigans. I don't know that there's really a treaty requiring this sort of legislation. On the other hand, it makes sense and helps us fit in with the rest of the known universe.
And there was one other point that the court really did not address, although they mentioned, and that's national security. And I thought part of the reason Congress enacted the CTA was around concerns by Treasury, FinCEN, and other government agencies of the national security implications of money laundering, of sanctions, of export control, of financing, of terrorism, and other similar concerns. It didn't look like the court really tackled that head on, but I wanted to ask you your opinion of that argument and how you thought the court may or may not have handled it.
That's why the statute was enacted in large part. The concept is to get at exactly what you mentioned, namely entities that are being used for nefarious purposes. And it is the Financial Crime Enforcement Network, after all, that is enforcing this. It is not something that is just a strange little bureaucratic agency. It is something that was specifically designed to help head off financial crime. And one would think you might give more discretion, more acknowledgement of the power of FinCEN to develop this sort of regulatory structure. Plus, if you look at the history of the legislation, it was a bipartisan support for this legislation that passed it. So even in a divided Congress that we currently have, you can imagine that if Congress was going to revisit this and fix it, they could get it done in, let's say, a New York minute, because you would be able to get a lot of people, even in a divided Congress, to support a fix.
Mike, you had, in the first half of our podcast, you raised several concerns and critiques of the law as implemented and how it appears it's going to be enacted going forward. One thing this court decision really didn't do was address any of the concerns I thought you raised in the first half of our podcast. And I wanted to ask you, did I get that right? Or were some of the concerns that you raised touched upon in the court opinion?
No, I don't think the concerns I raised about privacy and data security were addressed at all. Now, those are not really constitutional issues. So the court was asked to address the constitutionality of this statute, and it did, largely saying, no, we don't believe that it's constitutional. But those concerns about privacy and data security remain. It's an enormous database that's contemplated by the statute, with 33 million filers as projected, and very rich data that could be traded on the dark web and otherwise, and jeopardize the security of the people who are doing these filings. So I don't think it's really a constitutional question. I would add one thing about this, which is the court did not issue this as a nationwide injunction against the statute. And FinCEN has taken the position that the only people who are protected by the decision are the named plaintiffs, one individual and the trade organization that you previously mentioned. For many people, we would caution that if you're a newly formed entity, you should comply with the statute, notwithstanding the concerns about privacy and data security, because if this thing is on appeal, if it's found to be enforceable, people could be in trouble by failing to meet the deadlines, particularly if they're not in the Northern District of Alabama. And secondly, this is the sort of thing that could well be reversed quickly, or at least a stay put on the effectiveness of the decision by the 11th Circuit when it goes there on appeal.
Well, Mike, you preempted the last question I was going to ask you. So well done.
Sorry about that. I didn't mean to jump the gun here.
You didn't. That was great. And it really seems like a good way for us to end this segment. Most unusual series of events between our podcast and the decision and the posting of this podcast. I wanted to thank you again for really taking the time to hop on this issue and get it in front of our listeners for their consideration as well.
It's a pleasure to do that. I think you should post this promptly so we don't see any more developments.
Mike, unfortunately, we're near the end of our time for this episode. But before we leave, I wanted to end by asking you, is there anything else that you wanted to add or we didn't get to?
No, I would just suggest that people take this requirement seriously, talk to their lawyer about it, talk to their accountant. Many accountants are set up to help people comply with this statute. And if all else fails, go to the FinCEN website. There's a FinCEN website dealing just with this. It's fincen.gov/BOI for beneficial ownership information. It has a nice detailed report on what's required of people. It also has the form that needs to be filed. And if you don't want to read that much, you could go look at my LinkedIn account and see what I and the members of my law firm have published on this subject.
Let me just ask one more site. What's the site for your law firm?
The site for my law firm is steinbrecherspan.com. We're trying to get Steinbrecher to change his name to Smith because it's almost impossible to spell, but he is resisting that request. So it's steinbreckerspan.com. Just drill down, look at our blog posts, look at my high school photo or whatever that is posted there now, and we'd be delighted to take any inquiries from people who generally want to know what's going on. as I said, also LinkedIn is pretty good, has a couple of things for me on there.
Mike, I wanted to thank you again for taking the time to visit with me. This is one of the most under-the-radar major changes in legal requirements and regulations we've had in quite some time, and I hope we can continue this conversation.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Good to see you again.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, our network sponsor for this month is Ethoco. I have partnered with Ethoco to help you figure out the ROI of your compliance program. I've written a white paper on that that's available at the website listed in the show notes. And Ethoco has developed an ROI calculator to help you determine the ROI of your compliance program. I hope you will check out both of these items this month. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope you'll subscribe, rate, and review wherever great podcasts are listened to. The award-winning FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.